Hey everyone, welcome to my second episode of my new podcast, Ag Uncensored. And I guess I'm kind of going to go with tradition, because my first one was with, as you have seen already, even though this is recording at a different time, another Canadian company. Well, now I have another Wild Canuck, I guess, colleague in Rob Syke here, a kind of another legend in the Canadian precision ag world and beyond. So thanks for being here, Rob, for my my second episode, and we'll see how this goes. And
I think we had we were talking about this when we were last at a conference together, and you were just scoping out what this was going to look like. I think we were in Indianapolis, and so congratulations on getting it lifted off the ground.
It's been kind of a weird rush too, since, well, I did it all in person last week. So I was in Winnipeg last week and brought all my stuff there. And this is more the plan. What I'm going to do is how I'm meeting you now. So it's like 10 times easier. But anyways, for all of this, I figured what could be a good start before we just kind of get into the normal back and forth, maybe give some people that don't know who you are just a little background of just who's Rob and where things started and where things went. So,
judging from my hair color, you can tell that I've been around a bit. Background is farming, northeastern Alberta. Graduated in agriculture economics. Really started to lift my career up when I worked with a guy named Jerry Stoller for a number of years. He taught me a lot about plant physiology, soil chemistry, and crop nutrition. I've always been a kind of a computer guy, so that kind of has folded into my world. Built the AgriTrend group of companies, which was agronomy and precision ag, grain marketing, farm business management, carbon credits, and data management. That was acquired by Trimble with the earnout finishing in 2018. That was started in 1997, so that was basically a 20-year journey. And then I served as CEO of Dot Robotics Company, and we exited to Raven in about 19 months, and that's now CNH, I guess. I've written a couple books. I've done a lot of keynote speaking internationally, traveled a lot internationally. I've had a lot of different companies that I've started, lots of different companies, and currently founded AgVisor Pro and Visor Pro AI. So I've got a people-to-people connection platform and an AI for the farm equipment dealership space. So that's Cole's Notes kind of thing. I still run a peer group for farmers called the Power Farm Group, and so we have 20 farms in that peer group. And my footprint really has been international, from Kazakhstan to South America, Australia, and all over Europe and points beyond. So,
well, we don't need to do any more of the podcast. You just explained everything and we're good to go now. So well, to say the least, like I said, from way back in the day, 97 to now, you've been involved in it. And of course I know you've known my dad forever too. So that always connected things. But, for the most part, we didn't really meet too many times in person. It was more you and my old man kind of shooting the shit, I guess, and trying to figure out the world of precision ag before it really was, well, before it was ag tech, but before really, I mean, I guess I'll get your take on this, because, so 97, you're dealing with all the fun precision ag agronomy, all the tools, from imagery, like from my background, to yield maps, to as applied maps, to EM38s and Varis machines and voila. All that. And I mean, we had access to that 20 years ago easily, and even more. And I feel like, it's a big, big stage right now of what ag tech is. And, but yet we've been able to do it for a long time, and the adoption rates are kind of still low. And I know that's a big question I always bring up. What's your thought process on that all? Just like the storyline of, okay, we could do it then, and we were doing it, but then there's like a level where it's just kind of like the top 5% did it and they keep on doing it, and then the rest just kind of trickle in as they
this is a real conundrum for agriculture, actually. In 97, when I started doing our crop recommendations, our agronomy work with fax machines. I would fax you something. Mm-hmm. People don't know what that is anymore. You'd fax it back. And then I would put it in an Excel spreadsheet and eventually converted that into an Access database. And eventually we went to SQL. And really, I think we were one of the first online, fully functional agronomic and farming software services in the world, because we went into a cloud that wasn't even called the cloud back then. Mm-hmm. But when you think about those days, the 90s and into the early 2000s, I think I saw the other day took 11 years for the majority, and we're still not maybe even the majority of farmers, to start adopting auto steer and GPS mm-hmm. guidance. And so that to me is a real telling point. Was it you telling me that majority of farming operations just they get in the combine, they turn off the yield monitor? Is that?
I don't know if I was telling you that, but it makes sense because, like,
there's something that's just built into the combine. It can provide all sorts of information, and by and large, if farmers have it, a lot of times it just sits either on thumb drives or in files that we're not really downloading and cleaning up, or it's not used at all. And so there's a lot of technology that's low hanging fruit. And quite frankly, 11 years is too big of a chasm. We need to adopt these technologies faster for a variety of reasons. And probably the most notable being economic. But a lot of these technologies have not been simple to use. So
no, not
there's that too.
Well, and I mean, just looking from my past, I've seen probably more imagery of fields and agriculture than 99.999% of people on this earth. And there's parts of it that it's still complicated for me. I'm not an expert at necessarily GIS software. Some of that stuff is really hard. Like I even look at, you were close with Trimble, the FarmWorks mm-hmm. software is there. And then some of the stuff you developed too, it still can be really complicated. You hit the wrong button and, you mess something up, or you shift a zone or a pattern here that someone did. And then even grabbing that data, there's just all these little hurdles. And while some do it better, and now with internet more, most places, at least in the kind of modern US and Canada, although there's still a lot of spotty spots. And it's still just overly, it's almost like it's too much for most of the industry. Like I was talking with
that,
a group.
That the word I think is interoperability. Is it mm-hmm. easy to move stuff between different colors of equipment? Is it easy to move stuff between a sprayer and an air seeder or a planter and your combine? Is it easy to do that? And then shuttling it between data platforms, and there are a plethora of data platforms out there, drag and drop. There's a lot of human manipulation still going on. I remember back on the farm, I always tell the story, but back on the farm, we had a 930 case, let's say, and we were backing mm-hmm. it up to a John Deere chisel plow, and the cultivator had been left in the air. So we had a problem because the John Deere had John Deere ends on it, and the case had case hydraulics, and then there was Pioneer. So you had to literally release the oil pressure before you could change out the ends from John Deere to case or to use adapters. And we were always covered in hydraulic oil, just always on the farm. We're always covered in hydraulic oil. Today, mm-hmm. we're covered in digital hydraulic oil.
I was wondering where we're going to go with the analogy. And I've always heard of the coupler, the Pioneer coupler dilemma.
We're still dealing with that. You've got, here's, that's a good example. So you've got a Case and you've got a John Deere, and then you've got to have these couplers. You've got to deal with this digital hydraulic oil. It spills all over you and makes things messy. And in a lot of ways, we're still kind of dealing with that in spite of what everybody says about clean interoperability between platforms. It's still messy. And I think it creates a really good job opportunity for people to step in and connect your remote controls. All of us got four remote controls on the coffee table, so we need somebody to connect those things together.
Well, and to that point, I mean, in a large sense, that's why I suppose AgriTrend kind of became what it was, is people are willing to pay that, whatever, $10-$15 an acre, you know, wherever it was, to just just do it. You know, please just grab this data from wherever, put it together, go in my field, do the soil tests, understand my weather. Like, please just do this for me.
At one time we had, we were building in 2010, 2012 QR codes for grain bins. We made bumper stickers for grain bins and you could actually use your phone and snap and load up your grain bin and unload your grain bin to the contracts. And that was all built into a complete homogeneous system called AgriData Solution. We actually were to the point where we had the grain inventory of a farm hooked up to the Chicago Board of Trade, and you could see your balance sheet going up and down with depending on the commodity.
That sounds scary. I don't know if I'd want to see my...
That was quite a while ago. That's like 15 years ago now.
I don't know if I'd want to see my balance sheet go up and down during the day, depending on what the price is.
Well, it does whether you see it or not.
Well, yeah, you know, for sure, for sure. Yeah. I don't want to, I don't know if I want to see it though, especially, you know, if you go limit down on a certain crop, it's like, oh crap, I probably should have contracted something, or, you know, whatnot. Yeah. But well, and I'm going to have to turn that into a clip for sure, is that we're dealing with a digital hydraulic oil. Because I haven't heard anyone.
Hydraulic oil. Everybody's covered in it. Trying to make
I know. And it's so true. And it's like, you know, you see the big announcements, you know, John Deere's got See & Spray. They got this new thing, or whatever group has this new thing, this new robotic thing here and there. And you've experienced some of that with the DOT side.
Yeah.
And so I'll go to a few different points here. And of course that went to the CNH. And so, you know, you got an idea of kind of that, where they were going. I feel though, like 90% of the marketing around ag tech is for stuff that only like 0.1% of farms will even see or understand for a few years. It might get to 1%. Like, I know the See & Spray side, there's a lot of guys testing it, but you know, they're not trying to put an acreage charge to it. See, and it's weird and different. It's like, again, you talk about it, that it's going to change everything, but that's going to take like 10 years to like really siphon into the market.
Well, it depends again on one thing. I think it depends on the ease of use. So if you take See & Spray, for example, and this is interesting because Goldman Sachs said the size of the total addressable market for digital agriculture, according to Goldman Sachs, was $265 billion. And I have the numbers in my head from that particular presentation. They said that digital agriculture was going to steal about $62 billion worth of chemical sales, steal about $60 billion worth of fertilizers, steal about $2.7 billion worth of diesel fuel. Now, stealing really means that if you were spraying, broadcast spraying your herbicide and it was $20 an acre and you're covering the entire field, if you could use See & Spray, and you reduce that herbicide rate down to 80, you're down to 20% from where you were, then all of a sudden you're saving $4 an acre. And so the question will be, who captures that $16 margin that's left on the table? Well, John Deere wants to capture some of it. Case wants to capture some. Whoever is the See & Spray technology. And you know what? Environmentally, this is a great message, Nathan. Environmentally, this is a tremendous
Can
we get there?
Well, and will the input companies that are megalithic, will they allow it?
Well,
with their lobbying and all that, will they allow almost that process to happen? What do they fill the gap with? They got to fill it with something, or is it equipment companies end up buying input companies?
I think this signals, you know, some of the early forays of the chemical companies and the crop input companies into the digital world, and some have retrenched, like Corteva's gone into granular and retrenched backwards out of that space. Zarvio through BASF is a big question mark right now. You know, Bayer's still pushing pretty hard with climate field view. So, and Syngenta, Syngenta's got actually a pretty robust program. So if you were those guys, wouldn't you be pretty scared of Precision Ag, of digital?
Well, they seemingly don't do well at making money at it beyond tying it to kind of the sales process or marketing process to some of their other products. So, yeah, they I would be scared if I was them.
That's why I think you're seeing some of the collaboration between and the announcements between the likes of Corteva and John Deere and Bayer and John Deere and so on and so forth, because I think they're trying to get closer and closer to a very disruptive potential competitor.
Well, so I have a theory then, you know, because that will happen. I mean, I guess before I get into my theory, I mean, from you being, you know, you're running the, you know, the dot company, and I'll try to throw up an image of here or a link or something. Sold that to Raven, and then of course not.
Well,
too
that
far
wasn't
after.
My company. That was
yeah.
You were an emotional family out of Regina, tremendously entrepreneurial family.
Well, when I saw
trying to do something around the setting up the go to market strategy. Yeah.
Well, and when, because we were talking about this in Indy, I mean, so you were kind of you know, leading some of that charge, and Raven just kind of came to you and was like, "Hey, we're interested in this. Like, let's, you know, how did that process go?"
I think it was a brilliant move on Raven. They saw the autonomous conversation ramping up, and so what they did was, first of all, Raven's got a lot of really great technology. They have their own great technology, and then they grabbed Smart Ag, they grabbed Dot, which became Omni Power, and they really assembled in very short order period of time a bit of a portfolio that lent itself to autonomy. And then Case looks over the fence and says, "Well, that's where we're going to go for so for whatever 2.1 2 billion, a billion here, a billion there."
Well,
they acquired Raven, and then AGCO did the same thing with Trimble.
Well, they kind of had to, and it kind of maybe leads to my theory too. But you know, with the Raven CNH deal, and I wrote about this a little bit, but I didn't include this part. You know, when they bought Dot, I mean, that might have. Do you think that basically because of the whole side of the robotics automation side, because they need a platform? Mm-hmm. They needed something, you know, machine-like beyond what they have. They basically needed that to get another half a billion, $1 billion out of CNH.
Oh, I think they did, I think they did a very brilliant move there. I don't know what the future holds for the Dot or the OmniPower platform. I think that the future actually isn't good. But there was some technology inside that camp that they really could make use of. For example, path planning. I mean, we've got a startup, Verge Ag, who's done that stuff pretty good, actually. But that was built inside of the Dot platform. We had to have path planning built inside. And so that kind of software, that kind of programming that you needed to have, because you were building an autonomous platform, well, that's probably still very useful today.
Well, and I think they're probably, it'll be interesting because, you know, everyone wants a normal looking tractor, normal looking combine. But then of course I see this Nexat concept out of Europe. I don't, you've seen that, haven't you? The big bridge tractor, whatever they call it. Like the Dot is like a smaller version of that in a sense, but I think there's something to it. People are seeing, change the platform a little bit. There's a semi-want, or there's an opening.
Well, so the challenge there still, and you alluded to the cab, it appears that John Deere is going to come out with autonomy in tractors. but will retain the cab. And you can imagine the amount of cost that sticks with the cab. But there's an issue around not just the autonomous operation in the field, which is, you know, fairly easy, but you have to move this equipment between fields. And there you get into insurance, you get into road regulations, transportation, jurisdictions between states and provinces. It becomes quite a headache. And so I think that's, like, I just saw Kubota's new autonomy prototype.
Chrome rims on it even. So, you know, that's
cabless, you know. And again, what are you going to do? Are you going to tether that thing to a pickup truck to move between fields? Are you going to load it up on a some sort of a trailer?
Well, I don't know your regulations, but so from where I live, right outside of Fargo, and literally 4 miles from me is like the Grand Farm. Yep. So, you know, you got the old college farm.
Is on the Grand Farm.
Exactly. So they actually, and then there's an ethanol plant nearby. There's a soybean crushing plant going up, and then there's a sugar beet pile right nearby. And then the Grand Farm's right there. So they're actually going to test some semis, and North Dakota rules are like, whatever basically our governor or, you know, whatever they want, they kind of get. And the robotics side and drone world is like, do whatever you want, because there's two military bases here too. But they're going to test a semi, I know, at least that's what I understand, that drives itself from the piler to the farm and even to the ethanol plant too. Well, I mean, it's only a few miles. But of course, I think it's like, okay, shit. That is actually the same path I take my kids on to daycare. I don't know if I'm ready for that, too. So it's a real thing.
That's a pretty logical type of step. I mean, you've got all kinds of autonomy in mining operations. Again, that's closed loop. And then I think about feedlot operations where you have bunk drivers going every day, same route. That to me is something. What you just alluded to was, you know, semi driving on the road and that's on a public road, but again, it's kind of closed loop. So,
it's
not a question of really if, it's just when. When does this hit the majority of farms? And always, the majority is a strange term.
Like, well, and to the point earlier, you know, it's making that easy button, and that's been a big problem in precision ag tech and anything. And I've always like alluded to that is like, we farmers want pretty much black and white decisions. Like, yes, no, it turns on, it does what it does. That's why auto steer is fairly popular. It basically, you press a button, it does what it's told, and you go up and you press it again and it does what it's told. You get into the agronomy side of things. There's just no easy button in agronomy. Although some are trying to get there.
Yeah. I talked to a farmer one time in Alberta, and I talked to him about, why do you work with AgriTrend? So we had agri coaches and geo coaches. We had the data system, and he held up a thumb drive and he said, this is why I work with you right here. Mm-hmm. So he could grab that thumb drive, and all the agronomy, all the scripting was put into that thumb drive. He shoved it into his monitor, his controller, and it did the variable rate application for him. So that was his easy button. When we could do that for them and shove it in, and it did the job. And I think that's really why farmers still aren't adopting it as a high rate as it could be, because it's too much work for them to do and learn these programs and relearn them again the next year and stuff.
Well, you just look at, I mean, my old boss, when I was in crop insurance down here, I mean, he basically created this enormous chart. And his statement was, on average, farmers have 40 decisions every year to make. And they basically have to get all those decisions right in some form or fashion in order to get to the next year. And most of those decisions are, you know, when do I seed? What variety do I do? When do I spray? What chemicals do I do? You know,
those are 40 major decisions, and I would think in any given day of the heavy season, you multiply that by.
Well, he put it in these 40 main categories, and then there's all these sub decisions under that, and it's like, and I've farmed a little bit, and I got friends that do it, and I mean I have friends that are, or my cousin's younger than me, he's plenty good with technology. does he want to make a variable rate map from an image for free from my own, our own family system on land that is our families that he rents? No. He's like, I'll just put it in because, you know, I made $200 an acre on it last year because of what it was. Like, I don't want to spend an hour building that script for the field because to them it's worthless to do it.
We're seeing the margins tighten tremendously with the power farm group that I work on. We're seeing the gross margins decrease by $75 to $250 an acre this year.
Oh yeah,
back in the day when we were doing our assessment of variable rate technology and what it would bring, it would drop somewhere between $35 and $55 an acre back then to the bottom line by more efficiently allocating out the resources. So that today, that could be your entire margin given where we're at with commodity prices today. So it may be. It's always interesting. You know, in really good times, you can just put the hammer down and do what you've always done. But when things get a little bit tighter, that's when people do. In fact, one of the topics we're running in March here at our power farm meeting, and this March section is on labor, power, and machinery. And one of the topics, you know, can we do $10 better? Can we do $10 better per acre with labor, power, and machinery, just $10. And then if you replicate that in a couple other areas of the farm, now all of a sudden you're dropping, you know, $30, $40, $50 to the bottom line. That can make a difference.
Well, and to that, through all the years, what I always saw, you're right, when farmers are making it good, it's almost like I'm making it too good. I've made enough money. I don't want to dive into too deep in all the technology. Maybe I'll buy some new monitors or some new GPS stuff, something that's easier for them to kind of think of, oh, maybe I'll add this little thing. But they almost don't get in the mindset of wanting to buy, I feel, software with data and try to dig in. Some do, but some just
spend the money. That logistics tends to trump agronomics every time. So,
well, and then when it's not working, when prices are really down, then it's the total opposite. Oh, I can't spend that extra, you know, $5 an acre on that service or, you know that software too. I find that too.
There's some really, you know, there's some real practical type of things that can be done just from an agronomic standpoint. So sulfur, for example, you know, you take an elemental sulfur program and you put that on at 250 pounds an acre, and that'll sustain that sulfur for the next 3 to 5 years. And you pull that ammonium sulfate out of the drill box or the planter, all of a sudden the volume goes way down. And then it gets easier to do the variable rate phosphorus maps because that's actually an expensive nutrient. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of look at some of this stuff, and as things get a little bit tighter, then people, you know, people will get more creative, I believe. And we've seen that cycle before.
Well, they get more creative, but there's always this hesitance, and it goes from, oh, I made it, I did probably well, I didn't need to do it, to, oh, money's getting tight, but maybe I have to do it. And then, when times are kind of average, well, no one knows when the times are average because it's like, oh, we had a normal year. It's these extremes. And I did find though, and I still find it here and there, is there is this, the hesitance goes away a little bit when you can say, you know, yeah, prices were good. You were making good money, but you know, fertilizer was a lot higher then too. Well, guess what? Prices are down. Equipment prices are still the same. Inputs are still the same or higher. Like you gotta, it kind of kicks them into gear a little bit, but it's still,
well, some of that is correct. I mean, input prices have come down. Glyphosate's half what it was.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Ago,
yeah.
And urea's, yeah, nitrogen down to, the other day I was pricing it out. It's probably going to see somewhere between 50 and 60 cents a pound. But I wanted to mention something that dovetails into this conversation. Yeah. We mentioned AutoSteer, and AutoSteer is brilliant because you're not steering, it reduces fatigue, and there's no overlap. And you're all of a sudden you're not overlapping. And whether it's a seeding operation or it's swathing or combine, you're simply taking advantage of the whole row and not overlapping. The other one that really is amazing that not everybody is using it is sectional shutoff. In North Dakota, you got a lot of square straight fields, but you start
potholes too. Plenty of potholes.
You start getting into that pothole country where you've got irregular shaped fields and you've got a lot of double and triple overlaps. Like sectional shutoffs pays for itself very quickly. And still a lot of guys don't have it, but those that do go, my God, this is easy. This is an easy button.
Yes, I agree. And that's kind of like, there's a colleague of mine, and I plan to have him on here one of these days, but he said, you know, for ag technology, you know, the most, call it useful and adopted one right now is auto steer and stuff connected directly to it. You know, your sectional stuff too is connected to that, but really the automated steering and all the stuff with that. And he's like, you know what the one before that was? And I said, it's like, well, I suppose you could maybe call, you know, the GMO side. He's like, well, no, think of something more physical, you know, than that. And he's like, air conditioning, cabbed, you know, tractors with cabs and air conditioning. Think of what the world would be. I mean, some people still do that in certain areas. That was probably one of the biggest tech advances in all of agriculture worldwide. When you really think of it in the same realm as like auto steer, it's helping the fatigue, the atmosphere around you. We couldn't do much of all this fun ag tech stuff in the tractor and all this stuff if we didn't have a cab or it wasn't air conditioned where you're not miserable. I've sat in a versatile 800 with no air conditioning, dusty as hell, going up and down the field, you know, cultivating. There is something fun about it because you can like smell it. Like my dad will always say that. He's like, I miss the open cab because I could smell the soil. Well, I could tell. That's how we did variable rate back then.
For all of the people on here who won't know what a field marshal is, it's a one-cylinder, no-cab tractor from British Isles. And we had that on our farm, and I was swathing with that thing. So it completely open in the elements, and that's no fun. So where are we going next?
Yeah, well, so I guess, you know, to the one theory you were saying with the manufacturers, and then I'll jump in because I think you'll have a good understanding of this with what you're doing now on the AgVisor Pro side, because you're dealing with a lot of the dealerships and whatnot. But so, you know, there's all these biological out there too. Is that what the input companies maybe want to? Maybe is that why so much money is going into that? Is that they know their older formulations are almost kind of, maybe they might go the way of robotic tech and automation with where to spray. They still got to sell it. You know, they still have to have it. But if, to your point earlier, drops, you know, in say the next 20 years, 80% of what was sold for say whatever herbicide or whatever drops by 80% just because of the precision application, they got to fill it with something. So is that where the biological side maybe comes in?
I spent some time at Kimitec in Almeria in Spain, which is a company that's basically grabbing plant extracts and isolating those extracts, screening them for miticidal, insecticidal, fungicidal properties, and then isolating the molecules and figuring out where the molecules are impacting the plant reactions inside the plant. Those molecules can be combined, and they're all 100% biological. So, you know, today everybody's biological PowerPoints look remarkably the same.
I agree.
You know, it's a lot of anecdotal. Yeah, it worked great for me. Look at these roots, and they're really good. They're big roots, and then you should try it because it's really good. And they're it's good for the land and it's good for the environment. And I like it because it's biological. But there's going to be some really good winners out of this whole sector. And if you're a UPL, an FMC, a Syngenta, a Bayer, and you're watching the general populace just hammer away at chemicals, and I saw at Chemitech, they were basically screening out a biological Roundup. So they were doing the same thing the glyphosate does, but they were doing it with a biological. And it was very interesting. I saw it on the screen. And it was highly efficacious. And so, you know, what's Greenpeace going to say when they come out with a biological Roundup? Like, what are they going to say then?
Well, you know? Speaking of that,
I think these things are coming. And in many ways, society is forcing us to have that discussion.
Well, and it brings up, I know there's this, I don't know the name or anything because it's actually kind of close to guarded secret, I guess, right now. There is this new chemical company where it's actually a natural process. It's been used in grocery stores and fruit and vegetable crops, but to create, it's been really expensive. And it's a type of fungicide, like antibacterial type chemical. And it's from like three natural occurring elements, and it's been used. It's totally safe. You can't patent it because the formulation has been used for like the last 150 years. But the problem has been it's hard to produce at scale. Well, they figured that out. So that's all the stuff that they're patenting, I guess. But they're trying to say it'll destroy the fungicide market because all the old formulations won't even make sense anymore.
They're just changing.
Because it'll work. It works better than that. And it would be automatically labeled under organic chemicals. So you could use it for organics, which is, you know, enormous. But it also does just as good. And you can do it for about the same price as normal fungicides. And later, I think there's more of that coming out. Yeah.
Later on this week, I'm having a meeting with a brand new technology that promises to produce a nitrogen product that actually could be classified as organic nitrogen. When you think about that, and nitrogen is the Achilles heel of organic production because you can't use urea, you can't use anhydrous ammonia, and you know, only so much manure to go around, and legume crops are 55% inefficient at their maximum. So nitrogen in organic production is a thing. So if you have these products that are biological and they're as effective as synthetic fungicides, then why wouldn't the marketplace gravitate towards them? They got to be good though, and they have to be reasonably priced, and then people will adopt them. I remember in my career, I started working with Elanco back in the day. We were selling Treflan, and you know, the field had to be black, and then we sprayed the field with Treflan, and then we worked it, and that was pounds on ground, not grams per acre, pounds on ground. And then we worked at 4 to 6 miles an hour, 4 to 6 inches deep, and then waited and then worked it the other way and then tried to get a canola crop to emerge and wonder why we couldn't get emergence after we had pulverized the soil and dried it out. But that chemistry that was back then was state of the art.
You don't have to remind me of Treflan. When my dad still farmed, there was plenty of Treflan stains on the equipment.
Right. Yeah. All that yellow stain. So,
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, you know, that was state of the art back then. And we tilled the shit out of the land to get Treflan and Avidex to work. Today, we don't do that. I mean, the whole idea of herbicide tolerant crops just changed everything. And canola, for example, went from being a dirty crop where you used four or five different chemicals like Fusilade, Lontrel, Post, and all these different things, muster. And then you just basically used a can of glyphosate per acre. And it just changed everything. It changed it into a cleanup crop rather than a dirty crop.
Well, and I think, I mean, there's going to be kind of the differences in geography of what people think about, you know, Roundup. And I joke to people that are, you know, maybe not aware of it as like, okay, yeah, there's all this, you know, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma from, they say, Roundup, and there's $1 billion court cases. It's like, then every single farmer I know that I've ever met in the Midwest and Canada should have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma by now.
Those are all civil lawsuits, eh?
Yeah.
All you got to do is convince the jury emotionally.
Do we get there with biologics, though, just in case? Like, do you think that? Like, because some people are worried about all the stuff that goes in the soil.
That has crossed my mind. Yeah. Just because it's biological. I mean, arsenic is biological. Does it make it safe? Nicotine is biological. So, you know, I think we're going to cross some of those You know, it's unnerving to me. I have another book I want to write called, I think it's going to be called Pragmatic with a capital A and capital G. And I've been trying to think of the byline. And I think really there has to be something that aligns agriculture, an alignment between agriculture and the consumers. We both want the same thing. All the farmers have families that are raised on those farms and eat the produce from those farms, the grains and the cattle and everything. And we all want the same thing, healthy, reliable, profitable, nutritious, environmentally sustainable, transparent food supply. So how do we align, get more alignment between agriculture and the consumer in particular, who just in the classic sense of the word is ignorant, not bad. Just ignorant about what's going on the farm today. And a classic example of that is you see a sprayer going across the land and the consumer will go, "Oh, I spraying poison all over the crop. Look at that poison. You're dosing the crop with poison." And they don't realize that it's 10 to 20 gallons of water per acre carrying a can of pop over.
Yeah, I literally got into, and the guy made a typo, I guess, but he still put it out on LinkedIn because they're trying to sell kind of a laser that kills weeds. You know, there's a
laser beam.
Yeah. There's like 50 of them.
And
their laser will solve all the problems. You know, we won't have weeds anymore with chemicals because the laser will just fix it. And I've joked before, I was like, well, okay, it's a plant. It's formed resistance for chemicals. What's saying it won't form resistance to a laser and get thick skinned or things like that? But regardless, there's just no simple answer to all of these things.
Instead of Roundup Ready resistant weeds, we have laser resistant weeds.
Yeah.
I don't know about that one.
Well, it kind of maybe brings back into that it'll become a battle between the input companies and manufacturers of, well, our chemical works. What
powers the laser and how does that fit into greenhouse gas?
Yeah, and all that. And I mean, I'll be honest. I want all these, you know, with the agri-food companies, I think they're going to start, they already control a lot of the narrative marketing. I feel like they're going to start controlling a lot of the narrative on the tech side because if they can find easier ways to kind of control the narrative with how a farmer grows a specific ingredients, and then they can sell that as what you said earlier, sustainable, healthy, all this. Like if my kids, they love Cheetos. Well, if that Cheeto is as healthy theoretically as a carrot at some point, but they can call it a Cheetos carrot, it's orange and that, but it's just as healthy. But because they put all these ingredients together, much like people are mashing 100 different ingredients to create a veggie burger and it's called healthy. Like, I guess if it is better for my kids, I'm like, I guess I'll grab the Cheetos carrot because they think of the Cheetos brand. And so we'll connect the dots
There's a bunch of things overlapping here. And we have to be careful what the consumer is actually thinking. So if I asked you, this is unscripted. If I asked you, Nathan, why do people buy blueberries? What's the number one reason?
Because they like the color purple or blue, purplish blue.
Okay. You're actually in one of the top three. Most people will say people buy blueberries because they're healthy. And that actually doesn't even enter into the top three. We're in an economic down cycle right now. Money is tight. So the number one reason people buy blueberries is actually it's luxurious. It's an indulgence. It's indulgent for them. So it's like the lipstick effect. Mm-hmm. When times are tough, lipstick sales goes up. The second reason is because they're tasty. And the third reason is they're pretty. So if you're going to market blueberries today, you would market them as an indulgent or a deliciously indulgent, tasty, pretty treat for yourself. Mm-hmm. And so the alignment again between the consumer and what the agri-food companies are bringing to the marketplace. You are saying a Cheetos equivalent taste, but nutritious, made out of carrots. Okay, that's good. The other side of the equation is what is the sustainability index? And that really interests me because if you have two loaves of bread that are identical, one has a sustainability index of 89 and the other one has a sustainability index of 53. Would the consumer pay extra money for the 89? Now, I argue that when the consumer is all banded together in a tribe and they're at a meeting together, they're all banging and saying, yeah, we want sustainability. But I think that if you put a camera on them in the grocery aisle by themselves, I think they pick 50.
Yeah, I will. I mean,
yeah,
because I'm like, eh, the difference is I'll never even know it tastes the same, or actually the other stuff tastes better.
The other day I was in a grocery store and I photographed eggs. You can buy eggs for 12 cents or you can buy eggs for 83.3 cents an egg. It all comes from the same part of the chicken. The difference is the marketing associated with that. And there's very little nutritional difference between those eggs. I mean, somebody will say, oh, yeah, there is omega and all this kind of stuff. I bet you it's pretty negligible. Anyways, bottom line is who buys what? And I always see the 12-cent eggs always cleaned out and the 83 ones sit there a long time. So
yes.
Even though they're stealing.
I'm on the grain-fed train, like, okay, it can the grass fed beef, fully 100% grass fed beef is disgusting to me because it tastes gamey and it doesn't have all the fat content. If it can be grass fed up to about the last 3 months and then give it some grain and it finishes it off nice.
Technically, all grains are grasses anyway, so corn and wheat.
Exactly. Like actually.
If you want to slice it and dice it,
I know. The
regenerative movement is talking a lot, and I like a lot of the conversations around regenerative because it gravitates around soil health, which I think is good. But a lot of it is about the integration of livestock, and so Hollywood is trumpeting regenerative agriculture, and then the other half of Hollywood is saying livestock's killing the planet. So I don't know how this all squares up.
I'm worried that, you know, cow farts will turn into like a biological health spa gas or something. Maybe that's what they're going with or something.
Yeah, you know, right now the beef herd is
it's the largest since 1958 or something like that, or smallest.
No, it's smallest.
Yeah, smallest. Yeah,
smallest. The peak of the herd was in 1975, I think, at 121 million head in America. Dairy-wise, we have 9 million rough dairy cows in America that puts out more milk than 25 million dairy cows did in 1950. So this is technologically advancing, and so we get more production out of fewer animals. And then if you square that away with what used to be on our Great Plains, which was bison and buffalo and all the other ruminants, and those were somewhere in the number of 60 to 90 million.
Oh, yeah, it's huge.
So they were around. So, you know, again, you look at all you mentioned, you know, you mentioned GHGs and methane. Well, methane has a half-life of 10 years, and carbon dioxide has a half-life of 1,000 years in the atmosphere. Now, methane is 28 times more greenhouse gassing than carbon dioxide is, but that burp came from the grass, and that carbon in the grass came from the carbon dioxide. So when the cow burps it out, it's a biogenic cycle. It ends up back where it came from. It started out with carbon dioxide, the atmosphere went into the grass. The cow ate it. It burped out methane. And it'll get back to carbon dioxide. So the only way that cattle can actually make more greenhouse gases is if there's more cattle. And unfortunately, the peak of the livestock herd was 1975. So
yeah, a lot of the livestock scare tactics, I think, are just that. They're scare tactics.
Yeah.
Of course, it lasts.
They're driven by an ideology. They're driven by a vegan ideology. That's where a lot of this thumping comes from.
Yeah, there's a show on Amazon that me and my wife watch. I can't think of what it's called again right now. But anyways, yeah, basically, when you die, you can transfer your brain to like a digital version in the cloud. But they went on this farm recently, and there's one cow, and it's like 100 feet long, and it's got like 100 different udders, and it's automatically doing different kinds of milk and curds and cottage cheese directly from the udder, and then like the ham side is just as glowing blob of like biological ham sitting in a barn, and you nothing's living, but it's living, and you can just like cut out ham in a blob and it looks like ham.
Well, if you take cultured meat right now, a lot of people say, they don't like factory farmed animals that are fed, fructose and corn from GMO corn. So they don't like that. But if you take cultured grown meat, the cells have to be given energy to divide. Mm-hmm. That apparently comes from sugar. And that sugar comes from corn. So you're not okay with, you're not okay with a feedlot. You're okay with meat grown in a laboratory, fed fructose from corn, which to me is a whole lot more factory than the other one.
I will take a good old normal steak any day over that. And that's my story. But anyways, we could keep going down this path.
Well, there's lots. These are all points of discussion that I think.
Well, they're core things that we in ag need to talk more. And I think it dives into the ag tech side of it. And so this is where I maybe want to go next. So for one, maybe you didn't do it as much earlier, but so now you're doing the whole AgVisor Pro stuff, and it's I think of it more right now. It's almost kind of there's a social media aspect to it, and that messaging and conversation, but it goes some other steps. And I know you're diving into the AI side, because that's the next kind of big thing. You know, we've talked about some of the general tech issues, the hardware stuff. You know, there's the biological side, chemical side, and there's just the food side. Well, now we have this whole different beast of what AI is and isn't. It's early. We're not even. Well,
so yeah, there's two sides of my thinking here, and I put money behind both these. And the first one is people to people connectivity. So AgVisor Pro is an app you download on iOS and Android. We built an algorithm that will match the questions that you ask anonymously, or you can put your name behind it, but you ask the question, and that question will be geotagged and will go with an algorithm to experts and companies in those subdomain categories. And they can respond, and you can connect, and it's really a people-to-people platform. From the standpoint of AI in general agriculture, I think the best we're going to do in the near term in general agriculture is augmented intelligence. It may augment the intelligence of a vet tech, or it might augment the intelligence of an agronomist, but replacing it's just not going to happen quickly.
Well, I've had another friend of mine said, yeah, it's not that knows AI very well. Craig Ganzel, he's been around it. Yeah. And yeah. with his FarmWave stuff, he's always said it that way. It's augmented intelligence. There's nothing artificial about it. It's basically, he's like, we're taking what we can do and just doing it, you know, 1,000 times faster in our brain.
Well, if you ask AI ChatGPT what phosphorus does in a corn crop, it'll tell you what phosphorus does. But ask it to program the amount of phosphorus to hit a 250 bushel yield target. That's entirely different. What we've done with Visor Pro is we separated out this into an AI, and we're using Visor Pro to help the farm equipment dealership space. And so we create a vault. So for example, Torgerson's out of Montana, we create a vault for Torgerson's, and we load up their operator and service manuals and short line manuals into their vault. And then a question comes in from a farmer, and we literally can extract that answer out with a technical reference back to the manuals inside their vault. So it's a defined thing. You know where the answer is coming from. It's not fabricated. And this is very exciting because we can dramatically enhance the customer service using Visor Pro AI. So, and then eventually I could see the AI backing AgVisor Pro eventually as we get enough information in it. But again, staring into the future, I think there's still a lot of room for agronomy, precision ag people to connect these dots. Maybe the distillation and analyzation of the data might be something that AI could help us with. Because again,
I was almost thinking the other day, maybe the easiest, I mean, there's all those, you know, LLMs, large language models, and then there's all this other stuff that can be done with the AI side currently as it sits. And And honestly, like the logo that I made for this podcast, I just typed in what I wanted and a few little tags of what I wanted it about. And I went to this AI website, made it in, you know, seconds. It made 1,000 different versions of my logo in seconds. And I could choose between all these different versions and I can change it instantly. And it cost me $60. I was like, that's amazing. I've hired like, you know, I did a like a competition.
That's scary if you're a Fiverr logo.
Well, gear. Yeah, I've used some of those before to make my other logo for my company Boundary with my novelty play rugs and all that. There's my one shameless plug for each episode.
No, he's got a thing where he makes rugs based on a photograph of your farm, and then you roll out the rugs and your grandkids can play on it. My God, what a wonderful thing. Buy it.
And so there's the good shameless plug to go there for anyone listening. But to that point, like it was so easy. And the logo I did before when I hired someone like on Fiverr, it was actually called 99 Designs.
Yep.
That was $500. And it took a week. Now there was like 100 people battling over it, but I probably could have got the same thing done. So I think that like, okay, in like a software, you know, a farm management software, stuff we've dealt with, and things you're building, you know, and we talked about the adoption issue. You know, people just don't want to use it. It's too complicated. Maybe where the AI actually comes in is it's just you train it to operate the software the way someone thinks. And you use it that way instead of, oh, you have to hit this button. Instead of you're telling the software, find some dates between this and this of this data, you know, whatever. And make me a basically variable rate mapper. Just clean this prescription map, and it just does it.
The other
grabs
day
it from all the places like that.
I was making a Excel spreadsheet, and I had to have this complex formula. It was an if and or formula, and I could not figure out how to program it. So I just wrote out what I wanted to do in ChatGPT, and it generated the formula. It was cut, paste, worked. Beautiful. Exactly. So some of this stuff is going to really reshape how we see the world in as little, you know, in 2 years from now, the world will be different. However, when it comes to agriculture, I think the best we're going to see is the significant augmentation of the information that people are using, and maybe the more rapid distillation and usability of the data. That would be good if we could see that.
Yeah, and I think it can be used to bridge some of these smaller gaps that are just, you know, like you said, looking through the manuals in your Advisor Pro. And I mean, I've dug through manuals.
We're taking 20 minutes, 30 minutes, boiling it down to very short period of time with a higher degree of accuracy, too. So that's
And like if I'm needing to fix a part, I'll just call it on my fridge. If I could just ask, which I, you know, I'm sure they have it. Samsung probably has an app now for their stuff. I don't know, like, how do I replace the compressor so I don't, you know, because they go out every 7 years and it'll go out. Like, how do I do it? And it gives me a step-by-step. I don't have to go through the manual. I think that, I mean, that's kind of what you're...
As we see AI advance, it'll go multimodal. So it'll be speech to text, text to speech, and then it'll integrate with video so that you have more image recognition and instant access to videos like YouTube videos to change your compressor. So, yeah.
Of course, this brings up maybe kind of an ending final point. There's a few different parts that we can talk about here. Because maybe we got another 15 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Okay. So you brought up an interesting quote. I think it was last week or the week before on a dumb internet. So talk through that a little bit, because I think it's an interesting conversation.
I just did a survey on this in the last 2 weeks. I did a survey on this. So the quote I use in my slide is, you can't have a smart farm with a stupid internet. Yeah. And, you know, John Deere made an announcement that they just teamed up with Starlink. And, you know, a lot of people would say, why do we need that? Well, 25% of America, Canadian included, has virtually no internet access in rural areas. 75% of Brazil, this was really a Brazilian play, has no internet access. Now, I did a survey, and it was very consistent. I went across LinkedIn and a couple other platforms. And I asked the question, is lack of internet, is lack of broadband harming your ability to adopt smart farming technology? And it was yes, somewhat, or no. And mm-hmm. it's overwhelmingly is over 75% of farmers responding is either 61, 66% say yes, and then some say somewhat. And it's only about 20, 25% that say the internet is adequate on their farm for smart farming technology. So you talk about a hurdle. Again, a real big barrier to making this stuff work is connectivity. And a lot of the technology today is cloud computing. So you have to send the information back up.
Yep.
Edge computing is very expensive. You have to do the processing on the machine, and all the programming is on the machine. So it's really hard to upgrade. So, you know, we need to have better broadband coverage in rural North America. It's like a foundational infrastructure, roads and bridges. We need roads.
We've been lucky in North Dakota because all the different phone companies came together in the early 2000s and they formed this new, they call it the Dakota Carrier Network. And they put fiber optic everywhere in North Dakota, everywhere. I think we have the fastest, you know, internet basically in the country as a whole for people. Like, I mean, we 5, 6, 7 years ago, you could get a terabyte, you know, or gigabyte up per and second,
down. Yeah,
you
right. know, gigabyte in, down. Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. In the middle of nowhere. And, you know, some states are just, you know, in some states it's harder. Like, I mean, I've been to Pennsylvania and, you know, there's the rocky, you know, kind of areas of the iron range or whatever there and, or whatever they have there. You just can't put a fiber optic cable down 10 miles in a day because you can't, you know, in North Dakota, yeah, you can do that pretty easily. You could just string it along and it'll be fine. There's nothing in the way. So yeah. I think that's where, you know, Starlink is definitely going to help on that a lot.
Big deal. I mean, you circle all the way back to the beginning of the conversation is what is hampering the uptake of more technology and farm level. Some of this stuff is pretty basic. It's hard to use. My internet is crap, or it's expensive, or there's nobody around to help me service it. So again, we created AgVisor Pro so that people can get on the app and ask a question and meet an expert they otherwise wouldn't meet. And problems.
Some other conversations I've had, especially with some kind of the high value crops, you know, fruit and vegetable side. Mm-hmm. And it's been, you know, and I remember hearing this back in when I was at Agritechnica back in 2007, that there's so much land that can open up that can actually take overproduction of stuff that we'd even do here in North America, you know, in other countries. But one of the barriers is, you know, infrastructure and money. But part of it too is just the educational side is with things like Starlink and all that. Once it's easier for people in the middle of Peru to make vegetables that are the same quality and price as the Central Valley in California, but for a tenth of the price, you know.
Well,
it's going to start to happen in the grain side. It already is in grains.
I'll jump in with a couple examples here. The one crop that Canada absolutely controlled the world price on was blueberries. We dominated the blueberry market in the world. We don't anymore. Peru does. Peru is the dominant blueberry producer in the planet today. The other thing is you bring up, land. I have an interest in a farming operation in Uganda, north of Gulu towards the Congo. And that land, when we broke it, had never seen agriculture and is capable of growing two crops a year. Yep. And it's amazing. And there's lots. I mean, there's lots of land in Uganda and Tanzania, Kenya, that whole area there.
And the whole Africa is the central part of Africa is just that area in itself could feed the world. It's just the infrastructure, the politics has been
you've got geopolitical instability, and then you've got infrastructure issues. And then you've got, they don't know what they don't know, but they're just like they leapfrogged us. They don't have landlines. They just all went to two cell phones in their hands. Nigerians all have two cell phones in their hands. We can utilize that technology to leapfrog agriculture by not having them go through all the iterations that we went through to get to where we are today. Like, just
of course,
get there faster.
Of course, maybe there's a fear in this too. So another the kind of ending point, you know, we talk about, sustainability, traceability, carbon, all that fun stuff. And that is a big thing here, Western Europe, you know, in call it the more, first world countries. That is the big thing. Well, if you could say switch 75% of the agriculture production to say a country that doesn't really care about that at this point, the carbon, the sustainability part, they just need to grow it and they can do it for cheaper. Is that a big threat to ag in itself?
I don't go very far. I mean, California has all sorts of rules that's pushed vegetable and fruit production into Mexico. So,
well, is corn, like, corn and soybean production, so much has been shifted into the, South America. I could see could be large shifts of that with certain things, headed to Africa in the next 50 years. And then it becomes,
how
does that change the dynamic?
There's only seven regions in the world that are capable of producing more food than they consume. And we happen to live in one of those regions.
Yeah.
Africa is, Nigeria, average population is, or age is 17. That population is going to explode. It's over 200 million today. Yep.
It'll be
wild. So the ability of those areas to generate more food production is there. I think the number one export we can do actually is the export of knowledge to help
them. Yeah, I agree.
And that'll be fun to do. It'd be fun to watch it.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so, okay, final thought here, because you brought it up before we got this. You've been in the business side of ag forever. There's all this stuff going on. You're very, we talked a little bit about everything here, and I know and right now it's kind of a hellscape, and you're having to deal with it in your own realm. You've done it in the past, but the investment side of ag tech, where is that to you?
Well, it's really shifted. So I founded AgVisor Pro, call it 2019. And at that point in time, it was all around building a connectivity channel. So the metrics were average monthly users, acquisition cost, how quickly can you add users? It was all around the metrics of growing the network effect inside the application. Today, nobody cares about that. Today, the metrics have all changed to profitability. How quickly can you get to cash flow positive? And so it is a very, very hard environment. And there are a lot of startups right now that, rightly or wrongly, are drying up and blowing away. Mm-hmm. We've got a seed round available right now. That seed round has been a rolling close. It's been open now for about 18 months. It has been an absolutely brutal period to try to court any investment. Thankfully, we've lived long enough, I think, that we'll start to turn the corner with some of our metrics and start to see ourselves being more appetizing to some external investment. But had I not been my age and had I not had my resources, these ideas that we're talking about today would have blown and dried up and they would have been gone in the history books.
Well, and that's what I get kind of concerned about in the larger sense. It was so easy to get money in a sense for the last 10 years, it seemed, in a lot of cases, and now it's stopped, which is good to that. Because there was so much, there are so many things being invested in that just are like, we're not there yet.
Well, your previous guest on the previous podcast, that was an example of a company raising a lot of cash, and that cash is all blown away. And
like $500 million. Although I will say they have built, they have digital assets that they're trying to sell with. They built it, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of code that they've built. Of course, selling that is its own thing. And I know that better than anybody coming from the trying to sell satellite imagery. It's
You download AgVisor Pro, you look at it, and it's a very elegant app. It's easy to use. It's very well designed. And you stare at that and say, that's wonderful. And I go, yeah, that's millions.
Yeah. And that's, it's so expensive to do, yet finding the revenue streams. And I mean, everyone wants all this ag tech. I saw one this morning, like technology in ag can save farmers and save the world. And then there's another article, cows are destroying the planet. And no one knows what the hell they want anymore. And it's confusing. I feel investors are like, I guess if you have sustainability and carbon in your name or smart world, like, okay. Well,
let me wind this up with a quote that was in the book. I wrote two books, Agriculture Manifesto and then Food 5.0. And in the book Food 5.0, How We Feed the Future, the quotation that I have in the book is this one. And that is, at the end of their time on this earth, the one thing a farmer should leave on this earth is more earth.
That I agree. We very few have done that.
So, late. So there's a good closing argument or a good closing point that at the end of their time on this earth, the farmer should leave more earth on this earth. That tells you everything you need to know about how we harness all of these different topics we talked about today.
Well, and yeah, it's a good ending to, you know, that there's a lot of hope for technology. There's a lot of things it can do in agriculture, but it's not as simple as throwing money to it. Of course, you need money, but you need the right people and understanding to actually solve that real problem, which, yeah, at the end of the day, the real problem is feed people with, or feed things with what you have, and then leave more when you're done. Yeah. So that it doesn't go away and the next generation can do more. But anyways, I think we've gone over time. We'll have to do a follow-up, you know, like 6 months from now or something, see where things are at, or,
you know, I think the world will be different 6 months from now again.
Considering the political stage of, you know, here in the U.S. and the world, yes, it's going to be a lot different in 6 months.
Well, you have a lot to be excited about. There's lots going to happen.
Yeah. Perfect. You know, everything's perfect.
All right.
But anyways, thanks Rob for being on my second episode here of Ag Uncensored, and
best success with it in the future. And you do have a spot in this industry because you're one of those neutral independent players and people like to hear from you.
Well, and no one's paying me to do this either. So I'll just say whatever the hell I want, I guess, too. And the worst they can do is not buy imagery from my dad. I guess that's the worst they can
do. Pass Lanny high when you see him.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, thanks again, Rob, and all the best, and take care. And for people listening, follow Rob on social media, follow his business, check it out. Also like and subscribe to this whole thing too. And we'll catch you next time. So thanks again, Rob.
Okay, see you, Nathan.
Bye.